Hey everyone, it's Tristan here. At Sex Out Loud, we unequivocally support Black Lives Matter and the current uprising for justice. Some of the shows, like the one you are about to hear, were recorded prior to the beginning of the uprising, so I want to provide that context. These discussions are still important to have, in addition to the fight to dismantle white supremacy, examine the roles we play in it, and champion Black Lives Matter. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluid?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. You know, at least once a week, I receive an email from someone pitching themselves or their client for Sex Out Loud. These potential guests are overwhelmingly, if not exclusively, white, able-bodied, middle and upper middle class, professional, heterosexual, often conventionally attractive, cis women and men. They are described as therapists, coaches, intimacy experts, sexual empowerment coaches. They promise to talk about things no one is talking about. For example, getting what you want in bed, how women must claim their orgasms, self-love, the pleasure gap, why women's pleasure is a radical act, helping women get in touch with what brings them joy, sex as a tool for personal development, three things that stop women from getting the love they deserve, how to embrace your sexuality and enjoy sex once more. These are actual direct quotes. I usually pass. So if a white woman shows up in my email, I need her to be a few things: intersectional, anti-oppression, inclusive, offering a fresh perspective, some new ideas, practical tools. So I'm going to be honest. When I saw the title of this book and the picture of the woman on the internet, I was like, maybe not. Maybe it's another one of those. Then I read the book, which surprised me entirely on several levels. And remember, people, I read a lot of fucking books. So I'm really excited to welcome this guest and talk about her work. Let me tell you about her. Jan Dworkin, PhD, has more than 25 years of international cross-cultural experiences as a couples therapist and leadership coach. She is co-founder of the Process Work Institute, a nonprofit graduate school dedicated to research and training in process-oriented psychology. She served as its academic dean for over a decade and continues to teach training workshops worldwide. Jan coaches leaders and teams across sectors, specializing in conflict facilitation and leadership development in creative industries. She's the author of the book, Make Love Better: How to Own Your Story, Connect with Your Partner, and Deepen Your Relationship Practice. Based in Portland, Oregon, she lives with her partner, Jerry, and their corgi, Maddie. Welcome to Sex Out Loud.
Thank you.
So I like to start with a quiz question. It's like a pop quiz, and it's about something that has to do with your book, but then it doesn't. Are you ready for your quiz question?
Before you give me my quiz question, I just have to say thank you for that introduction. That was an incredible introduction. It really moved me, and thank you.
Oh, you're quite welcome. So my quiz question for you is, one of the things that you talk about and will talk about in the book is burning some wood. Mm-hmm. Can you actually make a fire?
Can I personally make a fire?
Yes, can you make a fire?
I want to say that I can, and I think I probably could if I needed it to survive.
Okay.
But it's been a long time since I actually made one. But I can make a fire. Wait a minute. I'm not telling the full truth. I can make a fire like in a fireplace, mm-hmm. for sure.
Okay.
I'm not bad at it.
Okay, good. Good. And then there's a lot of talk about dreams in your book. So I want you mm-hmm. to tell me, what is the most recent dream you had?
Wow. That's quite the question. I actually had a dream last night that was so disturbing to me that I decided to forget it. And I think that was connected with some of the troubles that are happening in the world right now. We're not living in the best times. But let me think of the last one that I remembered. It was my birthday. I actually had a birthday dream. In my dream, I dreamed that I was gifted by a very, very close friend, a very dear friend of mine, a childhood friend. I was gifted a piece of jewelry. And the jewelry came from Indonesia. And that was the dream. Hmm.
How'd you feel like when you woke up?
It felt good. I liked the dream. I worked on the dream. And I got to a very... I learned something interesting about the dream that actually relates a little bit to my being on this podcast, interestingly enough, because my association to, when you work on dreams, you know, you work on associations to different parts of the dream. My association to Indonesia was Bali, and I had just recently heard a moth show where Elizabeth Gilbert was talking about her experiences with the death of her partner. I don't know mm-hmm. if you heard that. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible performance that she does, and it's a very, very deep piece. And I was really moved by how authentic and how real and how raw she was. And sometimes I think that when I'm doing things like speaking publicly, or I'm on podcasts, or being interviewed for something or another, I try to act really professional and I want to be really smart. And this dream reminded me that the more authentic I could be, the more that my gift, that part of my gift was my realness and my rawness. And I should always remember that. And I get really hung up about being smart.
I think we all do. But that also points to, wasn't going to be my first question, but now it is. It points to one of the really refreshing things about this book, which is you break a major therapist rule and mm-hmm. you air your dirty laundry. You talk about yeah. your own relationships and sex life, your missteps, your wounds. And this laundry, I'm trying to say this as judgment-free as possible, this laundry can be described as very dirty.
Okay.
So I'm wondering why you decided to do that, and then how you actually got the courage to do it.
Okay. When you say dirty, can I ask you first, do you mean dirty in the double entendre sense? You mean dirty?
I do. Uh-huh. I do. It's messy and it's also sexual and it can be unexpected for the reader who's like, I've come to this professional PhD person writing a book.
Exactly.
And then it's like, it shifts tones and you're like, oh, wait,
exactly.
I've been snapped out of it.
Exactly. I mean, there was some intentionality in that. First of all, this book had many versions, and I wrote some earlier versions that were academic and that would have been the ones that you would have rejected had you received a query from me to be on the show. And I myself was bored by them. And I knew that I've always had this thing about self-exposure since I was a young woman, which I also write about. And I have a little bit of an exhibitionist side. And I have found over the years in my working community that when I can share about myself really openly and really honestly, other people find it helpful and feel not so alone. And I went through, as I wrote about my book, I went through a period of my life that I was very, very difficult when I was in my mid-40s, and I had an emotionally abusive relationship, and I felt extremely a lot of shame and very isolated, and I was a successful professional walking in the world like I could pass, so to speak. I could pass as a, quote, normal, middle-class, privileged white woman. Meanwhile, at home, it was hell. And I was having suicidal fantasies, and I was there was emotional abuse, there was some violence, there was addiction, there was drugs, there was everything that you would never have known was happening. And I felt that when I came through that, I felt that it was a way for me to use the privilege, A, of having come through it, and B, all the social privilege that I do have, to sort of show other people that even when you have all of this sort of mainstream privilege and success, it's not the whole truth about a person. And I didn't want other people to feel alone and to feel, you know, to feel crazy and to feel isolated, because I did. And I just felt like I wanted my experiences to be useful.
So what it made me as a reader do is trust you immediately. Okay. I talked about this on the show before, but I went to a workshop at a conference probably about 9 months ago, and it was given by a therapist, and it was about attachment theory. Mm-hmm. And she sort of announced to the group at the very top of the thing, I have a secure attachment style. Mm-hmm. And I felt immediately like alienated. You know, she was like, I used to have these other styles, but now here I am in my 50s in front of the room and everything's going great.
Right.
And it just struck me as inauthentic, also sort of like off-putting. And then there felt like there was this space between us, because like I don't have a secure relationship attachment style. Mm-hmm. So this was sort of the opposite of that, right? You're like willing to say, oh, hey, and here's the relationship where I fucked up this. Here's the relationship where this got fucked up.
Right.
Which is also, you're modeling what you are asking us to do as the readers, because there is a lot of practical tools in here, a lot of prompts, worksheets, mm-hmm. to say, hey, can we go back over our relationships? Let go of this idea that they are failures and ruins, mm-hmm. and mine them for information. Look exactly. to them to really dig into what are my hopes and my dreams? What are the things I needed that I didn't get? What are the things I needed that I didn't ask for? What are the things I wanted? What are the things I imagined? What's the fantasy? I mean, I feel like I've heard some of this before, but it's not in the way that you talk about it, because you really encourage a deeper, deeper look. Like, that was the thing I appreciated, is like, you constantly want people to go one floor below. No, mm-hmm. let's go one floor below that.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I was really trepidatious about was that, because I am currently in a happy relationship, I was so afraid that it was going to come across as a happily ever after story. And that if you do these things, then you'll be able to get this. Because I don't believe that. And I think some of it is just luck.
Mm-hmm. So I really appreciated that part of it. One of the things Thank that you, you write is relationships show that experts are made, not born. Mm-hmm. It takes motivation and practice. So that's one of the central tenets of this book, is a relationship as a practice, as a conscious practice, to look inside, to explore the dynamics, to even step back and look at the context of your relationship. I mean, one of the most useful, I think, like, lenses, is the idea that this is a practice and you can actually learn as you grow and maybe get more skilled.
Yes, absolutely. I think it is a conscious practice. And I think that we're not taught how to do relationships, so to speak, in school. We don't learn it. And it's like that saying, life is like learning how to play the piano while you're giving a concert. It's like, how do you learn how to develop relationship skills without being in relationship and trying things? And then how do you learn what to try? Well, hopefully my book is helping with that, but I absolutely believe that you have to practice these things again and again and again, and that they, many of the skills in the book don't come naturally. Many relationship skills don't come naturally. It doesn't come naturally to, for example, take the other side in a conflict, or to really have an awareness of when you're on your own side or when you're on the other side. It doesn't, many, many things that hopefully we'll talk about more specifically don't come naturally.
Right. And also, and if they also aren't modeled for us, right?
Correct.
Is that we have these models of relationships that can be unrealistic, can be sort of mysterious or hidden, can be hard to understand. You know, I think, I for one, when I was thinking about this section you did about what escalates a conflict and what de-escalates a conflict, I don't know that I ever saw my mother like in a conflict where she had to practice those skills. And when she practiced them with me, it always was about de-escalation through denial of my feeling.
Which is an escalation, really.
Well, that feels like an escalation to me, which is like, you're fine,
right.
Stop crying. And then it's like, of course,
right.
I'm more.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so we don't have models. And I think some of this points towards kind of practicing. It makes me think of like role playing, and I know people are gonna like scrunch their faces out there like, God, no, I don't want to role play. But the idea of like practicing how to do these things and practicing using these tools, even if it feels like awkward at first.
Absolutely. That's right.
We got to take our first break. Please listen to these great commercials. They support the show. They keep the lights on. And when we come back, more with Jan Dworkin. Hi, all. It's pretty difficult to talk about things other than what's going on in our world right now. So delivering these ads to you are tricky for me, and I want to be transparent and honest about that. But also, these advertisers make it possible for us to do the show. And I believe in the ability of this show to help people. I don't consider pleasure something extra or frivolous or unnecessary right now. It is absolutely a part of resistance, justice, and freedom. One of our advertisers is Uber Lube. They make a great body-safe silicone lube with only two ingredients, silicone and vitamin E. No additives like parabens, preservatives, or petrochemicals. It's great for all kinds of sex play. Uber Lube adds a thin layer that leads to just the right amount of slip while still allowing for skin-on-skin sensations. If you need some lube, they're offering Sex Out Loud listeners a special offer. 10% off and free shipping when you use my code Tristan at uberlube.com. That's 10% off and free shipping. Just use the code Tristan at uberlube.com. Uber Lube lets you feel what you want to feel. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, I want you to keep in touch with me, will you please? I want to remind you of our phone number, 323-SEX-8266, 323-SEX-8266. You can also email me at Tristan@puckerup.com. And you can also tweet us at Sex Out Loud Radio. Tell us your burning desires. Tell us ideas for the show. Tell us what you think about the show. I would really love that. So I'm talking today with Jan Dworkin, the author of Make Love Better, How to Own Your Story, Connect with Your Partner, and Deepen Your Relationship Practice. You begin, Jan, with this idea of dreams. And actually, dreams and dreaming are both literal and figurative in this book. It returns as a theme. But you have this very compelling sort of recurring dream, which has given you tremendous insight into yourself. Will you share the dream with us and sort of how it has followed you and how you've been able to kind of unpack it?
Absolutely. Yeah, and the dream is that it's actually an early childhood memory, and then there was a dream that followed after it. And that's the case that we can look back on our earliest childhood dreams or the first memories from our lives, which are also like dreams, and we can find all sorts of information about our entire life path. So in my story, the memory was a memory. It took place in New York City. I was walking with my mother during Hanukkah season, and we were walking along the street, and there was a big commotion in the street in front of us, and we came upon, I felt viscerally in my body started to tense up. I felt like something was happening. I didn't know what it was. But there, lo and behold, there was a guy who was a beggar, and he had no eyes. And as a child, this completely freaked me out. He scared me. His face was very ravaged and distorted, and he was begging for money. And I became inconsolable. And then my mother tried to get me to calm down. She suggested I close my eyes, and I walked holding her hand because I was so afraid to look. In any case, a few minutes later on the next street, we came upon another beggar, and this was a man with no arms and legs. And needless to say, our day was ruined. I was distraught. I couldn't bear the pain of what I was seeing. And for years, subsequently, I had dreams of being, nightmares of being chased by these various beggars in different states of so-called disability or deformity, as I saw it through my child's eyes.
And of need.
And what?
And of need, right?
Yes.
That they were
the need, the begging and the need. And,
yeah.
And I myself as a child was, I was extremely nearsighted. So I had a very severe nearsightedness for most of my life, where I was on the verge of almost blindness. And so I felt very vulnerable in my own experience of not being able to see. And I was always trying to cover that up. And I was a very needy child myself. I was very, very sensitive and needy. And at that time in my mother's journey, in my mother's life, she wasn't really able to provide the kinds of motherly love that I needed as such a sensitive child. And so she turned away from my need a lot. And I subsequently turned away from those beggars and didn't want to be anything like them. I never gave them money, so to speak. I mean, I was a child, but I couldn't look at them. I couldn't bear to see the pain. And I couldn't bear my own pain. I mean, there's a lot I can say about that. I don't know how deeply to get into it, but it, you know, in the book, I talk about how that pattern follows me through my life and follows me through my relationship life. And ultimately, how my deep vulnerability and my own deep sense of being unable is a superpower of mine. When I can show, in fact, that's what drives me to show my real truth in the book so transparently.
It really resonated with me a lot.
How so?
In a couple ways. One is that I also had a mother who turned away when I became emotional, right, and I was called sensitive,
right,
and overly sensitive and overly emotional. But also I started having this knee problem probably when I was like 10, and I saw a physical therapist and they wanted to do surgery. And my mom was like, what? She's 10. And I still have it to this day, but it's worked itself out in a lot of ways. And so I was excused from gym class.
Right.
And kids sort of teased me about this mercilessly. And then once a boy actually kicked me directly in the knee to dislocate my knee, which is what was happening, because he knew that I had a knee thing.
Right.
So it was like really traumatic. And I said a bad word or a phrase. This is in my memoir. I said something mean to him, and then we both got called to the principal's office, mm-hmm, and we both got in the same amount of trouble.
Oh.
And so that was also like a mixed message, which
totally.
Is like, there's physical violence, and then you like said something off color is what they
right.
would say back in my day.
Unfair.
Yeah. But also just the idea that this also is in your book, like when your partner does things that annoy you or make you mad or you don't like, that one thing to do is sort of pause and say, do I have this quality in me?
Correct.
And am I disgusted, horrified, ashamed, mm-hmm. whatever about it? Mm-hmm. And are they showing it to me? And I'm like, no.
Right. Exactly.
And I feel like I, you know, grew up to be a sort of over-functioning, over-capable person who's quite independent,
like, yeah.
and has trouble mm-hmm. asking, you know, for help and assistance.
Absolutely. I'm sorry about that story. That sounds awful.
And everyone can read about it in my memoir soon.
Oh, good. You're good. I'm looking forward to that. But, you know, the other thing about that story that's so important is that all of the parts of the dream and all of the parts of the story turn out to be different parts of myself, right? And different parts of my own path. So what happened to me in relationship, I got attracted to people who were overly needy or who were so-called beggars in different ways, whether it was because they were more emotionally needy than me, whether they're more financially needed or they just felt like unable to navigate the world in different ways that I was able to. I found myself in a sort of provider caretaker role. So there was nobody in the dream itself who was actually giving to the one who was begging. But then in my life, I became that person who gave so much to others, but was never able to give to myself what I was able to give to others. I should say that in the present tense, because I still struggle with that. Being able to treat myself with the same kind of kindness and love and regard that I treat other people. Not that I'm always that way with other people, believe me, but especially when I'm in a therapist role.
Right, right. Well, then you went into this helper role in your work too.
Exactly.
Which is really interesting. And this brings up another thing. One of my favorite parts of the book is where, this is a quote, "In order to have good relationships, it is essential that you understand the impact of your power on your partner." Mm-hmm. Power. Yep. Okay, first of all, I love power. I'm obsessed with power. I eroticize power. Mm-hmm. But we don't actually talk about power enough in relationships. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when you talk about power dynamics, you talk about it at the level of social location, like, mm-hmm. is there a difference here in class, in race, in gender, in ability? But also, like, your own history and sort of personality. What mm-hmm. kind of, what's your personality? Like, what's your power when you kind of walk in the room? Mm-hmm. I want you to talk more about that.
Yeah. I mean, many of us have a fair amount of awareness about our social location. Many people don't, but those of us who are interested in social justice and who put our attention on that have some awareness on about our social location, our gender, our sexual orientation, our race, religion, all of those other things, and how they relate to the environment that we're in, whether we're in the majority or the minority, according to the culture that we're living in. But, you know, we also have powers that are deeply internally sourced. And some of them we can develop through support and outer support. And some of them just have to do with the kind of personalities we have. So, for example, in the context of the United States, if you have an extroverted personality, you have a certain kind of power, a certain kind of privilege, because the United States values extroverts. It's a culture mm-hmm. that values extroverts. If you're, you know, a male extrovert with white skin, then you have all sorts of power. But even if you're, you know, so there's different kinds of personality traits that give you different kinds of power. If you love yourself, you have a certain kind of confidence. If you were raised by parents who really loved you, if you were really given a lot of support and love as a child, and I'm not talking about material things now, I'm not even talking about opportunities, I'm just talking about delicious love from a parent, then you come up with a different kind of inner feeling than somebody who grew up with a lot of criticism and a lot of hatred in their environment. So when we get into interactions with each other, also, if you believe in something, whether it's a social justice cause or whether you believe in something divine and you have a spiritual practice, you have a kind of centeredness, or your life has a sense of purpose that also gives you an incredible kind of inner strength and inner power compared to somebody who's just sort of floundering about, living a superficial life, who's knocked around by the wind, so to speak. It doesn't have any sense of purpose. So when it comes to relationship, the way we interact with each other depends as much on our personal powers as it does on our social locations.
This kind of cracked me open, Jan.
Oh, really? Say more.
Yeah. Well, so I got out of a 15-year marriage only several years ago, and it had a dominant submissive dynamic. Mm-hmm. So I was imbued with, consensually given, more power than my partner.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But on top of that, I feel like I had more financial power in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I was a public person.
Mm-hmm.
I was an extrovert. I didn't have any kind of like social anxiety or inability to like, you know, tackle hard stuff, right? I could just walk into a room and like make it work.
That's huge power.
Right? Mm-hmm. And also I feel this in multiple relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I am very verbal.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one. Mm-hmm.
And like in, you know, when I've been to couples therapy and therapy in general, like being verbal really gives you the edge.
Absolutely.
Right? Because if you, if that's not your language, if that's not the way you process information, if it's not the way you learn, if it's not the way that you communicate best, not everyone communicates best verbally, right?
Absolutely.
Then technically talk therapy is not going to be the perfect setting for someone who, for whom like their verbal is not their strength.
Correct.
So I also feel like I have this verbal thing. I have the ability, you know, like I have the ability to talk about my feelings and process them. And I feel like that could disempower my partners.
It doesn't necessarily in and of itself disempower your partners, but if you don't recognize that it's a power that you have and you just use it to dominate the situation, then it does disempower your partner. But the power itself doesn't disempower or empower. It's how you use the power, right? Because that's a gift that you have. Your ability to be verbal and to articulate is a gift that you have. But do you use it to take up all the airtime and dominate the space and tell your partner that they should be able to do that as well? Or do you use it to realize that you're doing that? Aha, take a pause, step back, maybe make a little space, ask your partner if they have something to say or whatever. So I want to really point out that the powers themselves are neutral. It's how we use them that makes or breaks the relationship dynamic.
In answer to your first question, I feel like my answer might be maybe.
Right.
As I look back on...
Right.
Because I also feel like when I say to my partner, like, listen, I want to hold space for you. Like, what are you feeling? Like, I really want to know. They often react with, they don't like react in the way that I expect them to. They don't be like, oh, great, now I have the floor.
It comes across as patronizing.
Yes, it does. It comes across as patronizing.
Because a better, a more useful, more helpful way to interact would be to say, okay, I'm going to shut up now. How do you want to communicate? Like, what would work better for you?
Right, right.
And just wait. Because in the style that you were saying, and I do the same exact thing, we're kind of telling the other person that they should be more like us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the ability to articulate feelings, to know what you're feeling, and to be able to articulate and talk about feelings in any kind of therapeutic context is a huge privilege. And that privilege can be totally misused and abused.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I see that really, really often happening in sort of very stereotypical gender dynamics between heterosexual cisgender men and women, where the guy is like completely floored by the therapist and the, you could see the therapist and the the female therapist and the female woman just completely like dominating the space, and the guy who's doesn't really know what to do because he hasn't been trained.
Mm-hmm. Or to give the floor to anyone. I mean, in work, in life, at school, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, we have to take another break. Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk about sex.
Oh, good.
Because, you know, sex out loud. And there's a bunch of sex in here. But also sex in the context of relationship. So stay with us. We'll be back. Hey, listeners. Tristan here. Have you been hearing the word mindfulness a lot lately? I mean, I seem to see it everywhere in the media, on book covers. It's seemingly everywhere. Here's the thing, it's not just a trend. Mindfulness actually works. For me, practicing mindfulness and meditation has improved every area of my life, really. But maybe you can't make it to a group or read a book or go to a class. No worries. Just download the app that I use, Calm. Calm is the number one app for sleep, relaxation, and meditation, and over 60 million people use it. Calm has sleep stories, which are like bedtime stories for grown-ups, and they can help you fall into a deep, natural sleep in minutes. Stories are narrated by iconic voices like LeVar Burton and Nick Offerman. They also have soothing music from artists like Sam Smith. There are guided meditations, breathing exercises, and so much more to help you relax and de-stress. For my listeners, Calm is offering a special limited-time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Tristan. That's 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library with new content added every week. Get started by going to calm.com/Tristan. That's calm.com/Tristan. Relax, de-stress, and find your peace with Calm. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. We are talking about the book, Make Love Better: How to Own Your Story, Connect with Your Partner, and Deepen Your Relationship Practice, with its author, Jan Dworkin, who, Jan, you have so many case studies in this book. Okay, wait, before I go into that. We talked on the break about, you know, how I revealed some things about myself, which I wasn't intending to reveal. I'm usually not the revealer in the relationship or in the interview dynamic. So I pushed myself to reveal like some of the real feelings I had when I read your book, because this is not like a breezy beach read.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
It was not a beach. It was, you know, yeah. It like, you know, that you can't help but be like, oh shit, have I worked on that? Have I addressed that? What did I do there? But then we also talked about boundaries, and that you said, you know, I don't want to go too deep with you and be the sort of therapist, because right. We're not doing that right now. Like, we have not invited people into a therapy session between Dr. Dworkin and Tristan. That would be fun.
We could totally talk about that.
Yeah. But I want to just make clear to people, I want to say explicitly like what just happened and what we were conscious of and how we did it the way we did it, just to give people an idea. Right. Okay, we're going to talk about sex. So one of the things that I loved, first of all, is that you approach sex in the way that you approach most things, with a social justice lens. And, you know, you say, quote, having positive, loving, ecstatic, and sacred sexual experiences is a privilege, one that is not equally shared. And then you go on to talk about what might affect people's different experiences of pleasure and being able to access their bodies and being able to access pleasure. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciated that. Mm-hmm. And I think you're also talking about sex as a kind of a piece of the relationship that can't kind of go unnoticed, right? Which I feel like so many people tell me, we were in couples therapy, I've been in regular therapy for 8 years and sex has never come up. And I'm always shocked about that.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, don't you think it's sort of ripe for a space where we work out power, where we work out our dreams, where we work all this stuff out?
I mean, some couples are just so entrenched in their communication issues and their conflicts, and they feel so on fire with the immediacy of what's happening in their relationship that sex is really on the periphery of what needs to be dealt with. And it's more like there's a situation of a hemorrhage and like just work needs to be done on the immediate problem. So that's just one kind of couple that comes in. But for couples who over time are in therapy because they want to grow as a couple, it would be very unusual if sex didn't come up. And if it didn't, then I would make it my business to ask about it.
So I want you to clarify, because you bring up the concept of sex addiction and you do critique it, but you also still use it as a term. Which generally I feel like the sex addiction industry is preying on people's shame. It's like very steeped in white Christian heteronormative views. And so I want to know, like, what happens when someone comes into your office and says, which is happening more and more, I'm a sex addict, or my partner is a sex addict.
Right. Well, the first thing I do is I ask them what they mean by that. And I don't assume I understand what that term means. So I find out what it means to that person. And it means very, very different things to different people. So one person might feel like if they're accusing their partner of being a sex addict, it might be because their partner is sort of insisting on a certain minimal amount of sex, regardless of the emotional tenor of the relationship. And the partner who's on the receiving end of that feels that they're being used to fulfill a need, which is fine as long as there's consent, as long as there's an emotional understanding that one of the partners wants to please the other partner. Mm-hmm. Right?
Because, yeah, you can eroticize that, and you can even eroticize being used as a sex object, right? But that's got to be consensual above board.
Exactly. Or even in the sense that it's not even eroticized. I mean, in the best case scenario, it can be eroticized, but even in other case scenarios, it's just you really love your partner and maybe you're not feeling sexual for various reasons, but you're still willing to please your partner or give them what they need in different ways because they give you other things that you need, and there's a sense of reciprocity and there's a sense of love that's flowing. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about somebody who says that they feel coerced or they feel like it's the emotional piece isn't being worked on. It's just about the sex.
Right.
So I might think, okay, but if somebody's complaining about their partner being a sex addict, it's not necessarily, you know, how do you address that in therapy if the partner isn't there? Then you have to work with the person who's present about what their problems are around saying no and making boundaries and what their fears are around that, and really help them learn how to stand up for their own position and make possibly different decisions about the relationship.
Right.
If somebody says that they're a sex addict, I ask them again what they mean by that. And I think, you know, in cases where it's a person who just feels like they have like a overly, you know, amped up sex drive and they're not, you know, it's a difficult one to answer because everything, as you know from my book, everything is very individual and very, very specific. You know, in terms of the individuality of people's experiences. So it's very hard for me to make broad statements about things. But if somebody's experience of sex is getting in the way and causing damage to other parts of their lives, their relationships, their jobs, their health, their well-being, then I think it's reasonable to consider that there's something compulsive or addictive, or at least an addictive tendency that needs to be looked at.
So one of the things I love about this book is the case studies where you aren't like quoting word for word from the therapy room, but you've given us these case studies with a lot of different configurations of people and a lot of different issues. And I think one of the clearest ones that I want you to share is because it just was so brilliantly illustrated, is the one about the two gay guys where one of them stayed at home and cooked dinner every night and the other one came home from work. I don't remember their names.
Oh, uh-huh.
Tell me about that,
that one. That was an interesting... But that one wasn't about sex.
No, I know. I'm switching gears.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. I was still going to talk more about sex. But in any case, that one was about communication. It was very interesting. One of the partners had a really high-powered job and came home. The other partner was working from home or was currently unemployed, actually, had lost his job. And was kind of at loose ends, trying to find a new path, and just had too much time on his hands and was really looking forward to his partner coming home so we could share what he was studying that day or learning and have, you know, really connect and chat. And when the other partner came home, he was accused of not wanting to connect and not being interested in the partner. And of course, the partner who was at home really needed a shot of self-esteem because he was feeling underutilized, really. And that case was about double signals and mixed messages and unintended communication. And what it turns out was the guy would like stare out the window when his partner was talking, the one who had the busy job would stare out the window when his partner was talking. And I helped him explore the signal of looking out the window because the other partner was, interpreting it as if it meant that he wasn't interested, you know, that he didn't care about his partner, he didn't love his husband. But really what it was that he needed space. He was just yearning for some time to himself because he came straight from his busy job to this wonderful dinner that his partner had prepared. But it was the last thing he wanted was to even have a conversation about anything. He needed some time for himself. So they had to learn all sorts of stuff about their relationship.
I thought it was really interesting too about how it revealed kind of these expectations we put on our partners to be a source of validation and self-esteem, and how that then it's so fraught that any sort of, it's like even if he glanced away for a minute, let alone sort of checked out, becomes like so painful, but we don't necessarily know that that's what we're asking.
Exactly. And what happened was the one who was coming home, I'm recalling it in more detail now, that the one who was coming home from work liked to have a few glasses of wine.
Yes.
And the wine allowed him to unwind and relate. And he was using the alcohol in a way, the signal, he was looking out the window and he was trying to space out, but he wasn't giving himself permission to really take time for himself. But in a sense, by having a couple of glasses of wine, it was helping him access the same state of consciousness, but it wasn't really helping him get in touch with what his true need was, which is just to take some time to say, I need this. Mm-hmm. From you, my part. I need you to understand that when I get home, I can't connect with you. It doesn't mean that I don't love you.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that I don't think you're an incredibly interesting person. It's just that I'm in a different place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like and he just the needs one to go have space when he gets home.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And the one who was home really needed to face the emptiness of his life. And he needed to realize that he was using his partner as kind of an audience. And he actually had this really deep desire to become a teacher. He was working in tech, I think, and he wanted an audience. He needed an audience. But he was unconsciously using his partner as an audience, and that wasn't working. So he had to find the courage to embark on a new professional path.
And did you do that?
Yeah, he did. He did. Mm-hmm. And they had class differences, I remember. That was a huge thing for the guy to embark on a new... He was being temporarily supported by his partner, the one who was home. And then in order to embark on a new professional path, he was going to have to get some more financial support from his partner. And that brought all sorts of class issues up and internalized homophobia because he wanted to be a successful gay man. He was living in a particular kind of culture that really valued professionalism. And there were all sorts of issues that were coming up there.
Yeah, I just loved how you kind of mine. It's like this one brief interaction/pattern, right?
Yes.
And then you just kind of mined it for all of these things.
Yes.
And just went layer after layer after layer. And that's what was like, it was like satisfying as a reader.
Oh, good. Well, that's the case with our signals. These little signals like crossing our arms or looking out the window or, you know, putting our hands in our pockets. We project so much onto nonverbal signals and we think we know what they mean. And we don't understand that really they're dreams that are waiting to be unfolded. And if you actually go deeply into the impulses behind the things that we do, we find all sorts of worlds of information.
And what can those dreams tell us?
Well, they tell us all sorts of things about ourselves, about our wholeness, about who we are. You know, for example, if I just focus on myself in the moment, I notice as I'm talking to you, I'm really enthusiastic, I'm really excited, I'm enjoying this conversation, but I notice, for example, my mouth is dry, right? So if I were to actually focus on my own dreaming in the moment, I would take a moment to put my attention on the dryness in my mouth and to see what kind of information it has for me or for us or for this conversation. Should I do that?
Yeah.
I won't be long, but let me just feel it for a sec.
Okay.
It's hard to do while I know that you're waiting and while, you know, the listeners are
okay,
waiting.
Okay, except we're not live, so technically no one's waiting.
Oh,
right?
Okay, perfect.
We can just, yeah.
So let me take...
We can just wait.
Let me take... That's right. Let me take a second and feel into it. It's funny. I actually feel... So I don't know where this is going to go. That's the first thing. Is it scary to focus on your signals? Because you know that they have information for you, but you have no idea what that information is. And that's why we don't. That's one of the reasons why we'd rather not focus on our double signals. So what I notice is my mouth tastes kind of a little bit sour. And I feel like I have probably bad breath. It's funny. And I'm taking a sip of water. And maybe it's interesting because we're talking about, I have an association to bad breath, and I think about what I've been hearing about mask breath. That especially with the healthcare workers who were having this conversation in the midst of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an association to the breath of and the struggles that healthcare workers are having with their bad breath under the masks. I don't know if you read anything about that.
Yes. And also I was in a mask for quite a while the other day and I was like, I know I just washed this carefully. Why is there a smell to this mask?
Right.
So I had that exact experience.
That's so funny. So it makes me think of two different things. It makes me think of one thing is that this conversation is connecting with people out in the world who may be suffering and struggling. And it just makes me want to think of the people that are listening and just send love and best wishes to people and just remember the world and remember our struggling world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing that comes up for me. It sort of deepens my feeling. And the other thing that then comes up for me is my own what you mentioned in the beginning about my own dirtiness and my own sourness and my own bad breath and dirty laundry. And I thought you were going to ask me before about we were talking about sex and sex addiction. I thought you were going to ask me about my own experience.
Oh.
And I got like a little scared.
Oh.
Because I thought, oh. I wonder if Tristan's going to ask me about my own experiences with sex addiction or why I found why that label was important for me at a certain point in my life.
Well, you talk in the book about how you felt like sex felt like the avenue to power for you. But mm-hmm. as you got deeper into it, you realized, wait, no. Like the power is within me. It's not, I don't have to go get sex, have sex in order to grasp it, right? I mean, is that accurate?
I mean, that was part of it. That was part of it, but it was also because I felt like I was using it as a way to gain self-love and self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't only just about, but well, I guess you could consider that power. That is a part of power, yes. But it was more that I felt that other parts of my life were suffering, that I felt like I was doing things that I didn't feel ethically perfect about. And I think that's where I think the piece where it became important for me to think about it in terms of addiction, because I needed to think, it's not that I need to stop having sex, but there's certain behavioral patterns or certain choices that I'm making that aren't necessarily good for my wholeness, for the whole of me, and for the whole of my world. So that was what I felt about that. And does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. But so you were like a little bit freaked out that we were going to go talk about that.
I was both. I was freaked out, but I also I think maybe I wanted to.
Oh.
Also, because I like the idea of the realness of it, you know?
Desire and fear, you know, sit right next to each other on the bench.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
So that makes total sense to me, which is like, exactly. I'm horrified and totally titillated. I'm into it, not into it. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's actually some thirst there.
Funny. Interesting. That's very good.
Raymond said that. Raymond just DM'd me and said, thirsty for it.
Absolutely.
Which is such a good
thirst to get a little bit more dirty and,
yes.
And yeah. 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 Absolutely.
Okay,
oh,
so
that's interesting.
Is there is there something about your sex life that we should talk about, that you wanted to talk about, that you wished I asked you about?
Yes, of course. Is there something about my sex life that I wish you would? Well, I think maybe. I don't think so. I mean, I think being the age that I am, sex is a big deal, because I'm 61. And I think it's really important that people understand that women in this age group enjoy sex and love sex, and sex isn't over after menopause, and that whole thing is really kind of stupid, and there's all sorts of ridiculous things out there that are circulating about that.
I mean, I went into early menopause at 41, and obviously, like, my hormones dropped. I had all these crazy symptoms. I had surgically induced menopause, so it was like, one day, and then the next day I was in menopause.
Right.
But yeah, if I said to my 20-year-old self, like, you're going to have the best sex of your life in your late 40s, I'd be like, right. Now, Tristan.
I know. That's exactly right.
But you're telling me this at an orgy where I'm actually swinging from a chandelier. but
that's great.
Yeah, no. And I think this is another part of your book that's refreshing, is like, you claim yourself as a sexual being and you refuse to kind of put that out of the room.
Right.
This makes me think, you know, Chris Donahue is a therapist in LA. He's written several books. He's been on the show before. And he talks openly on social media about dating, about hooking up. And, you know, there are therapists who give him all kinds of flack for it. Like, people right. do not want to know you're having hookup sex. People do not want to know you're on Grindr, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And he's like, but I'm a sexual person. And a lot of my work is around sex and claiming desire and letting go of shame. And so, you know, he really feels like this is a double standard and we can't sort of leave these parts of ourselves out, which I, you know, you return to the sex thing actually quite organically in the book and sometimes mm-hmm. also unexpectedly, like abruptly, like you're like, right. like all of a sudden you're like, wait, we're back. We're on sex now. What were we just on?
Right.
Yeah. So I feel like what comes across is that you've had a sexual life, you still have a sexual life, and that you are unapologetically going to share that part of you.
Right. I'm glad it comes across like that. I mean, sometimes I do feel scared, and sometimes I do feel with clients who are interested in reading my book, I need to say, you know, read at your own risk. You might learn things about me that you may want to know or may not want to know, and that may impact our future ability to work together, and that's your choice.
Right.
So as long as people know that they have that choice, then I think it's fine. But it is unusual for therapists to be that disclosing, and in the world that I want to live in, professionals of all sorts need to be able to be themselves. I just don't want to, I don't want to be part of a profession that I can't really be my true self. And I mean, it's of course, it's a matter of the moment when I choose to share what I share or don't share with a client. And I wouldn't do that haphazardly or without a lot of thought in the moment. But it was my path to write a book. I had to write the book. The book was in me. It wanted to come out. And I would have done that. I had to do that, regardless of what the impact was on my career.
That's a great way to end. Okay. We're out of time.
Okay.
I want to remind everyone, the book is called Make Love Better, How to Own Your Story, Connect with Your Partner, and Deepen Your Relationship Practice. It's published by Belly Song Press. It's available wherever you get books, and I've heard it's available at Powell's, which also has a thriving website. So if you're looking to divest from that huge online marketplace, find it at your local independent retailer, or you can go to Powell's. You can visit Jan at jandworkin.com. On Instagram, she is Jan Dworkin, PhD, and on Facebook, she's Jan Dworkin. Thanks so much for having this conversation with me.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. It was really great to talk to you, and I love your podcast. Thank you for your work.
I want to thank the person who makes this possible, Raymond Johnson. He's senior producer, he's engineer, he's editor, and he does it all, people, everything. New episodes go up on podcast platforms on Mondays. We would love it if you would review our show, which helps people find it. Until then, you can find me across social media platforms at Tristan Taramino, and the show is on Twitter at Sex Out Loud Radio. And before we see each other again, really just hear each other for now, take some time to talk about sex out loud.